Hello and welcome to the Nation of Writers podcast. In this episode, we'll discuss the life and work of Edith Wharton, who was born in 1862 into a tightly controlled society at a time when women were discouraged from achieving anything beyond a proper marriage. Wharton broke through these strictures to become one of America's greatest writers. Author of The Age of Innocence, Ethan Frome, The House of Mirth, and many more, she wrote over 40 books in 40 years, including authoritative works on architecture, gardens, interior design, and travel. She was the first woman awarded the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction, an honorary doctorate of letters from Yale University, and a full membership to the American Academy of Arts and Letters. For this episode, we are joined by Wharton scholars Anne Schuyler and Emily J. Orlando. You can check out their detailed bios in our show notes. Anne and Emily are interviewed by Nate King, Digital Content Associate at the American Writers Museum.
Well, thank you, Emily and Anne, for joining me today on the Nation of Writers podcast. I'm excited to chat with you both about Edith Wharton. I know you're both big fans. We are here too at the American Writers Museum. But first, before we get into it, can you tell me a little bit about yourselves?
Sure. Yeah, thank you so much. And first of all, it's a pleasure to be with both of you today and an honor. So I am a professor of English at Fairfield University in Connecticut. I'm also the E. Gerald Corrigan Chair in the Humanities and Social Sciences, and a position I've occupied since 2018. And I've been writing about Edith Wharton since the 1990s, first as a graduate student and then later as a beginning professor. And I've had the pleasure to work with Anne Schuyler in a couple of capacities, but one most recently, we have a new book that just came out this year, and I edited this volume. It's called The Bloomsbury Handbook to Edith Wharton. It's a compilation of like state-of-the-art scholars from across the globe weighing in on new interdisciplinary approaches to the study and the teaching of Edith Wharton. I'll mention that I'm currently editing and introducing and annotating a new volume of Edith Wharton's first book, The Decoration of Houses, which she co-wrote with Ogden Cotman Jr. My first book is Edith Wharton and the Visual Arts. So that's about it.
Great. Thank you. Yeah, that sounds fascinating. I read the piece recently in Lit Hub, excerpted from that anthology. So I'm excited to read more of it. And Anne, how about yourself?
Well, also, thank you very much for inviting us. And I love to be with Emily, who's always an inspiration for us here at the Mount. I have been at the Mount for 16 years now, actually, and a variety of positions at the moment. And for the last 10 years, I've been Director of Visitor Services and Director of Interpretation, which means I do most of the exhibits here and a lot of the various interpretations with the guide staff. So there's a lot of constantly evaluating Wharton's reputation and trying to tell our people, you know, why should you read her? The people who visit and may not know anything about Edith Wharton. And so that's where a lot of my focus is. I have a academic background in history, really. So I didn't come here with a deep knowledge of Edith Wharton, although I had read a lot of her, but I've learned a lot since then. So, we have fabulous resources here, which we can talk about later in terms of like the library and things for digging into to all things Wharton.
Yeah, that sounds great. I would love to hear more about the Mount. From what you said earlier, you're in Edith Wharton's library right now, which is like really cool.
Yeah. The Mount was built by the Wharton, Edith and her husband Teddy, in 1902, and they lived here until 1911. So after that, their marriage broke up and Edith moved to France. So they didn't live here for a very long period of time. So we always have to explain to people that we don't actually have original furniture and not many artifacts, but what we do have is the library, which is behind me, which is, you know, inarguably the most important part of the collection that you can have. And we got that back. She willed it to a god. Edith, when she died, she willed her library to a godson, and then that godson's family kept it in England, and then it was rediscovered by a British bookseller who eventually sold it back to us in 2005. So it's sort of a long story of how we got the library back, or part of the library back, but it's a tremendously important resource for scholars, for visitors, and I can talk about that now a little bit later if you want to, in terms of some of the actual items that we have in the library.
Yeah, I'd love to hear more. Like you said, the library's got to be the most important part of a writer's
It is.
Artifacts, right?
And when we get visitors in here, you know, we have to, in our regular tours, we always have to preface with, well, you know, the furniture's not hers because she took it with her, and they always think it's the original furniture. Of course, we can let people sit down in the furniture, which everybody's always excited about. But then when we get in the library, it's sort of like a gasp when we say, but these are her actual books. And when we bring scholars in here and visiting writers, some people are moved to tears, literally. It's you just sort of breathe in the air, which I'm doing right now, of some of the books that that she had. We have about 2,700 volumes or so. We're able to display in the library about 1,500. And Wharton designed the actual room of the library because she had a huge hand in the design of the house itself. So she had very specific ideas about the design of the library, inset shelves, movable shelves, so that the actual books were the centerpiece of the library. So that's how this library is laid out. And there are books with inscriptions on it from people like Henry James and Theodore Roosevelt that tell us a little bit about her friendships as well as her sort of life here and her interests. She did not do a whole lot of writing in her books, although she did do some that sometimes are very funny, but she did a lot of markings and explanation points or emphasis points in her books. And she was a big one for correcting her own books, her own punctuation marks. We have her original copy of her 1934 memoir that she wrote. She was living in France at the time, and she was only a few years before her death, but she wrote this memoir called Backward Glance. And we have that book here in the library. And in the front pages, she has pasted errata, essentially, pages of mistakes that if she were to have another edition printed, she would correct. And a lot of times they're word choice or something that got past the proofreaders. A lot of times they're just punctuation, things like that. So it gives you a real idea of her precision. And our executive director always says she was a born editor. You know, if she hadn't been a great writer, she would have been a great editor. We have amazingly precious books too. We have a book, What Women's Leaves of Grass, that was given to her by her great and good friend Walter Berry, who's like her intellectual soulmate, and they talk books all the time. And he gave her a copy of Leaves of Grass in 1898, and he inscribed it in his very distinct hand. He was a lawyer, in very neat, precise handwriting, and he says, the quote is, "Who can stray from me? I follow you, whoever you are, from the present hour." And that is actually, he's taking a quote from the Whitman pages itself. But it just opens up this whole area of thinking about her relationship and her friendships with some of the people who were the most important people in her life. Henry James was a great friend. We have many copies of Henry James' books that he gave to her with sometimes sort of baffling inscriptions. There's a copy of the Golden Bowl that Henry James gave to Wharton in 1904. And the inscription says, "To Edith Wharton in sympathy, Henry James, November 1904. And nobody really knows what's in sympathy. We have all kinds of guessing games with people. Sometimes one of Edith Wharton's favorite dogs happened to die in 1904, and it might be that. Also in 1904, Edith Wharton, in late 1904, she was working very rapidly and probably somewhat frantically on the House of Mirth. And she was under deadline and publishers had attained her deadline. And anyway, she was probably in a little bit of a tizzy. And it might've been that that Henry James was feeling sympathy for. We don't know, but it gives you a glimpse into sort of the enigmatic nature of their friendship. They had a friendship that they didn't need to speak, you know, it was that instinctive. And so that all we can learn from the library. And then one more of sort of the more striking books in the library is a copy of James Joyce's Ulysses, which is striking for a couple of reasons. One is because she didn't like James Joyce's Ulysses. she called it a turgid welter of schoolboy pornography. but she has it. And it is kind of an interesting story. Her great and good friend, Walter Berry, who died 10 years before she did, had an amazing library. He was an incredible book collector. He had about 8,000 books at the time that he died. And he gave them to his cousin, who was sort of a ne'er-do-well. But in a late codicil to his will, he said, he just gets first pick, so to speak, of some of his books. And she chose about 100 books. And we think this pre-publication copy of Ulysses, it was a private copy that had belonged to Walter Berry, is one of the books that she chose. So it's sentimental to her, probably because it belonged to Walter Berry, but it's also sort of unusual given her opinion of James Joyce's Ulysses. So that, you know, that can tell you volumes about, you know, you get just a little insight into her personality and her friendships at the time. One of my favorite books, and this is the last one and I'll stop, is the oldest book in the library is a 1546 book of Balthasar Castiglione in Italian, because she spoke and read French, German, Italian, English, Old English. And this is in Italian, 16th century, as I said. And it was sort of the Renaissance text for being a courtier. Any courtier worth his salt would have read this book. And so Edith Wharton loved the Italian Renaissance. She did a lot of research on Italy. Her first novel was actually a book called Valley Decision, which was about 18th century Italy. So there's a lot of books in this library that are like her research book. And perhaps that was one. It's a beautiful book. It's held up better than a lot of more modern books. It's vellum and all that. So yeah. We give library tours, special private library tours, and the library is also has been digitized by a scholar, a great friend of ours named Sheila Liming, and she has digitized the covers and some of the more important pages of the books that's available online.
Wow, that sounds fascinating. there's so many things I want to jump off of that, but perhaps I'll backtrack a little bit. Interested to hear that she, even after her books were published, she still was making notes on them, right? And as an American Writers Museum, we are beholden to ask the process question. So I'm wondering if either of you have any insights into her writing process, because it just from based on that, it seems like it was a process that never really stopped. So I'm curious if you have any insights into, you know, how she got her ideas for stories or novels or her other the expanse of her writing, which went, you know, across genres and forms. And also was the process different for any of those different forms? Or did she kind of approach her whatever form of writing she was doing in the same way?
I'd be happy to jump on that. And also just to follow up on the wonderful material that Anne just shared with us. I just want to say, Anne, I love the detail about Henry James inscribing in his gift to Edith Wharton. I think you said it was 1904, mm-hmm. in sympathy, because I always thought, and again, I was just thinking, you know, with no evidence, but I thought he was writing in sympathy as a kind of self-deprecating joke, because he would often make fun of himself because he, you know, was never as commercially successful as Edith Wharton was, with the exception of Daisy Miller, which is a masterpiece. And his works absolutely are critical masterpieces, but it was the commercial that he could not master as well, like as Edith Wharton. So I love that detail. I also wanted to piggyback on your excellent comment about her copy of Ulysses. I'm married to an Irish studies scholar, and we went to Dublin to celebrate the centenary of Ulysses last year. And I was reminded that it's not just Edith Wharton, but also Catherine Mansfield and Virginia Woolf were duly distrustful of this new genre. And one of the things that Catherine Mansfield said was, like, she wrote in a letter about the book, she's like, "I'm glad I'm dying of tuberculosis. This is the future of literature." And I'm paraphrasing what she said, but it was a version of that. But obviously it makes sense that Edith Wharton would have been aware of it. And it's perfect that it fits in with her library. To the question of her creative process, I know Anne can talk way more about this than I can, but I love the detail of her, I mean, first of all, being so disciplined as a writer, and more than any other writer I've ever taught, more than any person I know, the ways in which she would, if I'm not mistaken, be at her bed at the early hours with her two little dogs. And as a person who's also has two little dogs. This is very dear to my own heart. And with her hot beverage and, you know, scribbling, she wouldn't have called it that, but, you know, writing frantically, feverishly, until, you know, the hour at which she would entertain. And I know she had the luxury of a secretary to type up the pages. But I can talk more also. I know, Nate, you had asked about like who inspired her. I could address that now, or I could talk about it later. But the most disciplined writer I've ever encountered. And you see that when you look at her manuscripts. And also, like, she had such incredible control over the process of the making of each of her books. And it's so evident in her letters. And she hated the illustrations to the House of Mirth. And you know, as Anne knows, like, she cuts the illustrations out of her own personal copy of the first edition of the House of Mirth. And I always tell my students that. And I get why. I get why. I mean, it's like someone else took artistic license with the representation of Lily Bart, and it just didn't suit her image of her creation. But yeah, she's had enormous energy, and she was writing up until her decease. I mean, she's an incredible artist. I can't think of anybody who was as productive and disciplined as a writer.
Yeah, I would add only to that again. One of the best things that people really enjoy here at the Mount is showing her bedroom, showing people her bedroom, which is faces east. So, you know, she had this all in mind, perhaps, when she set up the room. And so the morning sun comes in and wakes her up at 6 or 7 o'clock in the morning, and she doesn't get dressed, doesn't put on her corset. She gets the dogs up, as Emily says, her servants bring her coffee. She had a telephone. She loved telephone. So, I mean, one of the somewhat contradictory things about Edith Wharton's maybe in terms of reputation is that even though we think of her as an earlier age, et cetera, but she loved technology, certain types of technology. And so she had a telephone, we think, in her bedroom. So she might have called out if she wanted something else. But you really didn't disturb her for those 3 or 4 hours that she wrote in the morning. Again, she credits the House of Mirth, as Emily said, with really making her a professional writer and giving her that discipline. So it was every day she would write until 10 or 11 o'clock in the morning or so. And again, the precision. One of the things that's interesting about The Age of Innocence, which, you know, is thought as one of her masterpieces, is how quickly she wrote it. She was sort of under the gun, kind of financially, and that she was supposed to write another book, and then her publishers wanted a quote unquote House of Mirth type book, and so she wrote it in like 6 or 7 months, and she wrote it in France, and manuscripts had to go back and forth. You know, she'd have it typed in France, and then it had to go across on a ocean liner to New York. So just sort of the physical process of getting this done so quickly, particularly like with The Age of Innocence, is just sort of mind-boggling. And then she did make a fair amount of mistakes, to her mind, in The Age of Innocence, factual mistakes. She wanted to get everything so perfect about who sang when and who was in New York in her time period in the 1870s that she set it in. And so we were lucky enough last 2 years ago, the 100th anniversary of the publication of the House of Mirth, to get her actual first her edition back. It was the first edition, sixth printing, that a book collector had collected and then was gracious enough to donate to us. So the sixth printing is about the one that most scholars think is where she kind of settled down in terms of not having to go back and make a whole lot of corrections. On that edition. So again, enormous precision, but also enormous speed. In that book particularly, it was really quite awe-inspiring. And then some other books, you know, she took a long time. Custom of the Country, I think it was like 6 years in the making or so. Her final novel, The Buccaneers, she never finished. She was only about 3/4 of the way through, and she was working on that for years. So, you know, you don't really know why certain ones just lit the fire and she did it really quickly for whatever reasons, and other ones took her longer. So, always fascinating. And to see her manuscript, Yale University, Beinecke Library at Yale has a lot of the manuscripts and her Donne books, or sort of her idea books, digitized. And it's just fascinating to actually look at the scratch outs and the changes and all that. It's really fascinating.
Yeah, it sounds so. I would love to hear, Emily, about her influences, like, and just with all those I see you, Anne, in the library and all those books that she's reading. I'm curious to know what other writers of her contemporaries or people well before her, who she found inspiration from.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I'm happy to address that. And one thing I would also add is like her ability to multitask is quite remarkable. And she was often straddling more than one creative project while also doing, and I think a well-kept secret about her is that she did a lot of work for charity, certainly during World War One, a lot of it public, a lot of it private. So that's, I think that helps us understand why it might have taken longer to do one rather than another, but incredible outcomes, really. To the question of like who inspired her, I almost feel like it's harder to say who didn't, but I'll start. I'll give a few examples. And I like to use her. I like to use Edith Wharton as a case in point with my students for like how reading great literature makes you a great writer. And so Anne mentioned Walt Whitman. That's probably her favorite American poet, which is wonderful because it also disabuses us of this notion that Edith Wharton was somehow like some straight-laced prude, which anyone who's read her knows that's not true. because Whitman was a little naughty, you know, in his verse, in his wonderful, you know, democratic, you know, verse. But she, like, I scribbled down some of her favorites, you know, certainly the French writers of fiction, Flaubert, Maupassant, Balzac, she loves. She loved George Eliot. She studied, you know, Berenson, knew him, became a good friend of him, obviously, of his. Oscar Wilde, Pater, Goethe, gosh, of course, Henry James, except for his later novels, which made her cringe. I'm paraphrasing a famous quote by Wharton. She couldn't read his later novels. The Brontes, Ruskin, Vernon Lee, Rossetti, Dante Rossetti, and his sister Christina Rossetti, the Brownings, all the Victorians. I mean, it's kind of hard to think of somebody that didn't inform her her fiction. She did a lot of she had a lot of intertextual conversations, like with the poet Dante Gabriel Rossetti, who's also the painter. He's like, I think, all over her fiction, but particularly The Age of Innocence, Newland Archer, our you know, beloved protagonist, you know, is enchanted by the verse of Dante Gabriel Rossetti, and he uses it to kind of, you know, well, how do I say this? He kind of starts to sort of live in a fantasy world that's very much informed by Dante Gabriel Rossetti's enshrinements of these imaginary beloveds that can only exist in a painting or a storybook. But yeah, I mean, those are some of the heavy hitters. She was so well read and in many languages, and I think that's what schooled her and made her such a master.
Yeah, and I would all and adding to that, in terms of again, what sort of the library tells us, a lot of the authors, a lot of the people that Emily mentioned, of course, are right behind me, particularly Balzac. And you know, she wrote in her memoir, A Backward Glance, she sort of called them awakeners, and she's got pages of awakeners of people who sparked her imagination growing up, which include poets and writers, also included people like Darwin and her interest in science and evolution and things like that. So we have some of her books by Darwin that survived in this library as well. And the library is sometimes, we call it her autobiography, in that it sometimes refutes things that Edith herself told us as she got older. So in her memoir, she very famously says her mother never let her read novels as a young child. And in this library, there are novels that she read as a young child. So it was, but she always says that in her biography, actually, she writes, or her memoir, she says, I was forbidden to read all the lesser novelists of the day. Well, not all the novelists, it was just the bad novelist, or what her mother thought was a bad novelist. But before me stretched the wide expanse of the classics, English, French, and German, into that sea of wonders I plunged at will. And then, so she also did write, in 1925, she wrote a nonfiction work called The Writing of Fiction. And in that, she's very explicit, talks about who she thinks are some of the best novelists, short story writers, and so that's really instructive as well. And again, Balzac is always mentioned, Tolstoy. And interesting, the library we don't have any English versions of Tolstoy, we just have French versions. Now, whether or not she ever had English versions and they just didn't survive, that's very possible, but we have Tolstoy in French, with some markings in it, which is rather unusual. She didn't usually mark fiction works. She marked a lot of nonfiction. Tolstoy, Thackeray, and George Eliot. We have the whole works of George Eliot also in the library. Her publisher one time gave her a book inscribed to the George Eliot of her time. So Eliot was the only woman that sort of made her top five list of the best novelists or so. And so George Eliot is in her library as well. And the only other thing I was going to say sort of about the library is the physical nature of the library tells you stories as well, the physical condition of the book. So for instance, some of the authors that that Emily talked about, Emerson, Whitman, Shakespeare, some of those books that were Wharton's childhood books, we can't really even display anymore. They're so well used, and some of them are falling apart. So they're very precious, which indicates, you know, obviously a lot of usage. And then there are other books that are barely even cracked, that are, you know, the bindings are so stiff. So, you know, you can maybe draw conclusions of that, or you have to be careful because she did have other libraries. You don't know, she might've had a copy of something. Some of Henry James' later works are not cut. Now, that doesn't mean that you didn't read them in another book, but as Emily said, she wasn't very, very fond of some of Henry James' later works. although she adored him. That's the thing with Henry James, is their friendship was so profound, and she just adored him. But she could be very critical. And his later works didn't hold up well for her.
Wow, that's what an interesting way to think about someone's reading habits, just to see how creased their books are. And I'm looking at mine now, and I'm like, oh yeah, I do read that one a lot. And it's funny too, some of my friends tell me I have too many books. I need to stop getting them, but I'm going to tell them to listen to this podcast and say, one day when I grow up, I'll have a library like Edith Wharton. You mentioned Anne, her childhood briefly for a minute there. I'd love to hear more about her upbringing and her family, because I think that's an important part of her story and in relation to her writing as well. So would either of you like to give a short, intro into her upbringing as from what I understand, an upper class family, right?
Yeah, I mean, she's from the family with which we associate the phrase "keeping up with the Joneses." I recently learned, and I didn't know this before, I learned it thanks to Anne Schuyler, that her husband Teddy Wharton is cousins with the actual founder of the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, which is a lovely, you know, synchronicity, because I think that reading Wharton's fiction teaches you all about money, but that's another conversation. But yeah, I mean, like, I think that there is, to Anne's point, there's a really big difference between what Edith Wharton discloses in her memoir and then maybe more recent biographical details that have emerged. And I mean, I'm not an expert on her biography. I do highly recommend all of them. And most recently, Hermione Lee's 2007, because it really positions Edith Wharton as a global citizen. And it really did a lot, by the way, to attract scholars from around the world. Now, like, Edith Wharton Studies is not just U.S. based, it's very international. And there's stars all across, you know, the world now. It's not just a, you know, an industry that's American. But yeah, I mean, I think that the way that she presents her childhood is like, you know, what, as one that didn't, of course, did not endorse a woman to be a writer. Like that was not an appropriate occupation for her. She's supposed to be a hostess and a wife and a mother. Her parents were part of the the exclusive 400 set that were allowed into Caroline Astor's, you know, ballroom. So like the New York 400, she's of that class. And I know that, like, at the end of her life, she was looking back on her marriage, and as it was recorded by her companion at the end of her life, she was remembering that her husband, Teddy Wharton, with whom she had a 28-year-long troubled marriage, read her, you know, her occupation as witchcraft. Now that's Edith Wharton's memory, right? Of it. Who knows if that's what he said, but it does kind of work nicely to kind of remind us that she certainly went against the grain in becoming a professional artist, right? But I'd love Anne to jump in on this topic.
Yeah, she, and this is, you know, her early life and kind of her growth as a writer is something that really interests a lot of our guests. So we spend a considerable amount of time on that topic. And a lot of it comes from her memoirs, but also other letters and all that that have been sort of some, in some cases, fairly recently disclosed. And so she was born 14 West 23rd Street, by the way, if anybody's paying a visit to New York. She didn't spend a lot of time as a child in New York, actually. She spent from ages 4 to ages 10, she spent in Europe. That's because her father, who owned real estate in New York, that's where the family wealth came from, actually. And so where, you know, the Joneses were definitely upper class, they were not new money. They didn't have as much money as people like the Vanderbilts and all that. So he found it more profitable to rent to take his family on an extended tour of Europe. So think about that as a young writer. You know, from age 4 to age 10, you're wandering on Europe with your parents. She had two older brothers, but they were like 12 and 16 years older than she was. So they were already off of prep school. So it was very lonely. On the other hand, think of all the things that you see and observe. And Edith herself always claims that she was a born writer, that she there's one story that she talks about in her memoir that she says she used to make up. She called it making up, which is essentially, even before she knew how to read, she would walk around a room with book turned upside down because she didn't know what was up and what was down. And she would pretend to read from it and make up stories. And she was a bit obsessive about this, apparently. The one story is that she was having a party or something, and she told her mother, "You entertain these people, I have to go make up." So, you know, you get the sense that she was a born storyteller, from a compulsive to write. And yet, as Emily said, that really wasn't what was done of women of her class, of girls growing up. So when she came back to the United States, she actually got typhoid fever around age 9 and severely ill. But so her parents brought her back to New York, and they did at that time give her a governess, hire a governess for her named Anna Catherine Ballman, who was a woman of German descent and an incredible woman in her own right. And they embarked on this very ambitious program of reading German and French and all this literature. But she also knew, and her mother told her, and it was part of the society, that her job in life at this point was to get married to the right to the right person. So she had a failed engagement to a man named Harry Stephen. She had what must have to her felt like a really exciting summer with Walter Berry when she was 21 years old in Bar Harbor, but he didn't ask her to propose. So she's at the time being pursued by Teddy Wharton, who is from Boston, a friend of one of her older families, and 12 years older. So she's 23 when she gets married and he's 35. And Teddy, there's been a lot of things written about Teddy. The tragedy of Teddy's life. I mean, he was not an intellectual, but he did sort of support a lot of her writing. But he developed what today would probably be diagnosed as bipolar disorder, a manic depressive behavior. Ironically, when they lived here, some of the worst symptoms started coming on when they lived here at the Mount. Edith would have been in her 40s, he would have been in his 50s. And that eventually, along with Edith finally kind of really embarking on the major part of her career as a writer, eventually led to their divorce and selling this house, and Edith Morton moved to France. Wharton's first major published work was, I mean, she had written some short stories and gotten them published in poems and things, but her first real major published work was The Decoration of Houses, which is her book about interior design, in 1897, when she's 35 years old. So after that, she wrote just about a book a year until her death. But she didn't do that much writing, at least published writing, you know, when she was in her 20s and 30s. It was a pretty rough time for her physically in terms of health. So she did, in terms of her education, I mean, we always say she was privately educated at home. I think, and Emily can I'm sure add to this, but in her later life, I think she really regretted that she didn't have what you would have called a classical education in terms of like the mathematics and some of the classics and things like that. She tried to teach herself Latin because that's not something that she probably covered with her governor. So we call her self-educated, essentially. I mean, she did have help, but she read. She just was a voracious reader.
Yeah. I'm curious, I think Anne used the term awakener. Wharton described some of the writers that she loved as awakeners. Would you describe her Edith herself as an awakener in her own way?
Yes, yeah. I would. 100%. Yeah, I mean, just to piggyback on that, or and this maybe dovetails, like you had asked us to think about, like maybe how we like first encountered this writer, Edith Wharton. I think it's worth my mentioning that, like, so I went to college in the late 1980s and early 1990s, and I was never taught Edith Wharton. And it's not to say that she wasn't taught. It's just to say that my professors were not introduced to her. And in fact, when I studied American literature, and my professor is one of my heroes, there were two women on the reading list, Emily Dickinson, and then we had a snow day, and so we lost Kate Chopin. So, but Edith Wharton now would absolutely be, you know, on that reading list. I didn't encounter her until after undergrad, and I can't remember if it was summer or The Cuss in the Country that I first read for pleasure, and then I was hooked, and then I started to take graduate classes, and everywhere I turned, there was The House of Mirth, legitimately, because every time I read that book, I find something new. But I do think, to your question on Awakener, I mean, I think one of the reasons that, to my mind, since I've been, you know, alive, I feel like she really does have more resonance than ever in my lifetime. And I don't want to say she disappeared, but she's been rediscovered, and, you know, of course, because of like the work of The Mound and because of, you know, scholarship, uncovering, you know, neglected works. But particularly, to add to everything I've said, because she really anticipated our current Gilded Age. And I've written about this recently, but I feel like she saw it all. She saw it happening. It's documented beautifully in The House of Mirth. And she also really understood power and how power functions in American society. She understood how money works. And in her fiction, when you have a character who, you know, bless her heart, Lily Bart, she's not street smart. I love her, but she doesn't know how to play the game, and she gets destroyed, right? She gets destroyed. She's not willing to compromise, not that compromising one's morals is a good thing. But so Wharton is a sort of a shrewd critic of our society. And I just think that, like, all you need to do is read The House of Mirth to understand, like, how to navigate academia, how to get tenure, okay, and also, you know, like corporate America, if I can just read one line from that book to help back up what I'm saying. Protagonist Lily Bart is, again, like, she's 29, she's marriageable, but she's unmarried, and her job, because she has no skill set, her job is to marry well, and she encounters, you know, some difficult people who don't mean her well. And one of them is this character called Bertha Dorset. And she's like a bully, and she has power. And she's a little threatened by, you know, Lily's beauty and such and so on, and her availability. But Lily grows, and she learns her mistakes. And like in the middle of the book, she's having a heart to heart with her friend, Gertie Farish. And she basically, she says to her, Gertie asks, you know, what is your truth, Lily? And Lily says, it's one of her best lines. She says, what is truth? Where a woman is concerned, it's the story that's easiest to believe. In this case, and I love this line, in this case, it's a great deal easier to believe Bertha Dorset's story than mine, because she has a big house and an opera box, and it's convenient to be on good terms with her. And I really think that is corporate America and academia. It is convenient, and you don't want to earn the wrath of the Bertha Dorsets. So I could go on and on, but that's why she is, to me, an awakener. And my students love her. Mm-hmm. And so there you go. Thanks.
One of the things that we have on our website is sort of the list of people I know, you know, in terms of, like, other authors, what other authors today, modern authors, contemporary authors, have to say about Edith Wharton, and the range of people who have been influenced by her or recognize, in, just as Emily was saying, that she's addressing these universal truths and timeless issues, and that she's not, as for a while her reputation was sort of old lady-ish and Violet Leaf, I forget the quote that she herself called it, something like that, you know, and she's not at all. And so if you're just willing to read it, I mean, Ta-Nehisi Coates has he wrote in 2011 about the Age of Innocence. He says, what I love about Wharton, the Wharton who wrote the Age of Innocence, is her empathy and ambivalence. And I do a book club every winter with a bunch of, we take different books, online book club. And Wharton's really good at like ambiguity and ambiguous ending. And for some people that like really bothers them. They say, well, doesn't you just say, but that's part of the genius of your writing. You can read the ending of The House of Mirth. You can read the ending of The Age of Innocence, and everybody takes a little bit different take on it, or you can read it in different ways. So for me, that's one of the reasons that Ellie's so subtle. She doesn't scream, she doesn't shout, she whispers, or she doesn't say things. And I fell in love with that, with her long time ago in terms of the style of writing that she has. And so, I mean, our challenge, Emily in her classroom and us up here, is to try to communicate that to the modern readers who sometimes do have an incorrect impression of her just as this elite white woman from a long time ago who doesn't understand, you know, real issues, which is not the case if you read her work, not to mention the works of hers that are specifically about Ethan Frome and Summer and some of her other Berkshire novels that is not about upper class New York society, but it's about very poor farmers and rural folks in this area. So it's always a challenge, but people don't realize the breadth of the work that she did.
I'm glad you mentioned that, Anne, because a lot of people think she's just a novelist of manners. It's like she wrote in every genre and she mastered the genres. And certainly she, I mean, Summer is a well-kept secret. It's an incredible tour de force. And it's, you know, beautiful coming of age narrative. And Ethan Frome, you know, is a masterpiece in and of itself. For some reason, I was never taught Ethan Frome in high school, like a lot of people were, although I think it's a little more sophisticated than one might want a high school novel to be, but it's slim. So maybe that's why it's there on the reading list. But yeah, she's Bunner's Sisters is another masterpiece that's starting to get some traction. People are starting to weigh in on it, but it's extraordinary. One of my friends, though, a colleague at Fairfield, asked me, though, how do you have any advice? Because, you know, it's so bleak, right? Her fiction can often be so bleak, but it's like, well, you know, she's holding up a mirror. That's what, like, she's not going to have the neat, tidy, happy marriages a la, you know, Dickens and Jane Austen. She's not going to do that. And she's writing from life. And I you just have to appreciate that, I guess.
Yeah, totally.
Just to add to that, I mean, again, sometimes we ask people, you know, have you read it when they come to visit? You know, have you read any Edith Wharton? And we'll then talk about The Age of Innocence and The House of Mirth and Ethan Frome. And a lot of people will not realize that she wrote Ethan Frome because it is so out of what their conception is of the type of novels that she wrote. And a lot of them read it in high school or younger. And we always say, read it again, because it really is a novel that you appreciate as an adult. There's so many layers in it. Not to mention how many ways you can describe snow or white, but there's so many layers in it and so many ways you can read it.
Yeah, I can attest to that. I grew up in New Hampshire, and even then I didn't read Ethan Frome in high school, but I did read it as an adult a couple of years ago. And it was a snowy winter in Chicago, so it felt fitting for me to do that. I've liked everything you've been saying recently, and it's made me think of, Emily, you used this in the piece that was in Lit Hub, the excerpt from the anthology coming out, but it's something Edith wrote in a 1925 letter to her friend Daisy Chandler, and she writes, "As my work reaches its close, I feel so sure that it is either nothing or far more than they know. And I wonder, a little desolately, which." And that seems to really kind of, in a way, sum up what you've been talking about these last few minutes, about how, to me, she was so far ahead of her time that she's, in a way, timeless, but also couldn't be more timely than right now, which that piece in Lit Hub is primarily about. And I'd love to hear more about how, I mean, her Gilded Age, just all the parallels to ours, even down to a global pandemic, are striking. I'm curious if you have either you have any want to share about basically why she's relevant today and not and why so relevant even.
I love that quotation because I think she knows she knows she's a genius, but she also knows she can read the writing on the wall. I was just recently talking to folks about how like she's born one day away from Virginia Woolf, right? Virginia Woolf is the 25th of January, and she's 20 years younger. And Virginia Woolf, obviously she's across the Atlantic. They didn't like each other. They didn't respect each other's work. And I get why. I mean, it's just the same way in which, you know, we think our parents are old fashioned or fuddy-duddy or what have you, but they're more similar than either one of them would have ever cared to acknowledge. And they're both women from a kind of comfortable position who had the luxury of writing also. And they're both what I would call feminists, but, you know, maybe they wouldn't have. But to go back to the matter, I guess, of okay, like, she, I think Edith Wharton knew with that quotation, "I wonder a little desolately wish," and desolate is a word she uses a lot, and I love it. I think she knew, she saw that the tide was changing. People were embracing modernism, the James Joyces, you know, and company, and the Hemingways and the Fitzgeralds. I think that was working against her. I think that the canon of American literature was getting built in the early 20th century, and it's built by a white male professoriate who's, you know, going to forget about her after her decease. And the Percy Lubbock 1947 biography helped to kind of do her in. They didn't like each other. As I tell my students, you don't want your frenemy to write your biography. So there's that. I think that, you know, the recovery, the renaissance of, you know, Edith Wharton studies, you know, beginning with a masterful biography by R.W.B. Lewis, which really does so much. If I'm not mistaken, I think that biography won the Pulitzer Prize, but it really kind of just opens up this huge moment. And there are a number of biographies that follow, and there's papers that are unlocked at Yale, and suddenly we have a new Edith Wharton to kind of understand. And there's still more manuscripts to be discovered. I mean, it's not just Yale, like her work is in libraries, archives across the globe, and some of it's, you know, been overlooked. There are letters to be found in first editions. So, you know, to change the way that we understand her. So I just think that she knew exactly what, I think she knew she's going to fall out of favor, but I think she knew she's going to come back.
Hopefully she knew that. Yeah. I think, I mean, the 20s was a little tough for her. She was, her novels in the 20s, which is the one I'm doing for the book club, which is Twilight Sleep, actually, Glimpses of the Moon and Mother's Recompense, they were starting to get pretty lambasted by critics. And that's when you start hearing but much more negative than some of her earlier novels. And that's when you start hearing she's out of touch with American society. She's old fashioned already. And I'm sure that really irked her. And it could have put her in a bit of a mood swing there. But as Emily said, I think she always knew the worth of her best work anyway.
Yeah, because it's like that's the time of when modernism was really big, right? So it, probably to her contemporaries, she wasn't new enough, you know, or whatever, which they probably just they just didn't get it, right? Like she was, yeah.
If I could just add one thing, and I'm thrilled Anne, that you're looking at those novels. I think The Mother's Recompense is brilliant. I think that's also a well kept secret. And for Twilight Sleep, that's a little, she's dealing with, you know, she's trying to document Harlem from abroad, and it's a little awkward and highly racially problematic. But one interesting detail about Edith Wharton is that the Harlem Renaissance novelist and short story writer Nell Larson loved Edith Wharton, and she's, you know, she's known for A Passing and Quicksand and three short stories, and then she left her career as a writer for a number of reasons and went back to nursing. She was also a librarian, but she, even though Twilight Sleep is really racially problematic, Nella Larson writes a letter to her friend Carl Van Vechten. And basically praises the novel. So, and she, and I argue, I have an article in 20th century literature on Nella Larsen's career-long revision of Edith Wharton's fiction. So like she read everything that she wrote and she nods to it. She nods to The Age of Innocence in her short fiction. It's like, so that's kind of interesting. I guess it goes back to the kind of point that there are people today, writers today from totally different demographics that are embracing Edith Wharton's fiction as they were even in Edith Wharton's lifetime, which is maybe surprising.
Yeah, that was surprising to hear about Nella Larsen. That Nella Larsen is featured in the museum's current exhibit, Dark Testament, A Century of Black Writers on Justice. So that's of which, you know, that exhibit spans, you know, the end of the Civil War through the Civil Rights Movement, that sort of 100-year period, which was also Edith Wharton's time. So fascinating that Nella Larsen was, I'm curious about, you know, getting back to our current time. One question I always like to ask for these, and it's a completely conjecture, we don't know for sure, but if Edith Wharton were alive today, what do you think she'd be doing? How do you think she'd be engaging with our current world? In that piece, Emily, I grabbed the quote, privacy, one of the first requisites of civilized life, would be appalled by what is broadcast across social media. I love that quote.
I feel strongly about that. And I don't know about you, Anne, but like I so often think, what would Edith Wharton say? That's what I say through my head. Like when I'm, and I say this to my spouse all the time, like if I'm in line, you know, at the pharmacy or the checkout of the supermarket, and there's someone having a really private conversation on the cell phone that should not be broadcast. And I just think Edith Wharton would just be shaking her head. And I think she'd be doing, like, there's an emoji for this, the face palm. She would be doing the face palm at so many of our behaviors. I think she would be horrified by Instagram. I think she would not like Twitter. I think she would like the shout outs that she gets on Twitter. I don't think that she would be divulging her private life on Twitter or on Facebook. So I think that, I mean, I don't consider myself conservative, but I do love some of those ideas that she, you know, celebrates about privacy and beautifully in the Declaration of Houses, but also in pretty much everything that she wrote.
Yeah, I think she'd be cringing a bit on some of the modern technology, although she was a great writer of ghost stories, as you probably know. Some of her best short stories are ghost stories, and she, in a preface to one of her ghost stories books, she talks about the enemies of the imagination, which at the time were the wireless and the cinema, and because it came in between, you know, again, the imagination of the reader, you couldn't get scared by a ghost story, you know, she didn't think, if you've got the wireless cracking over in the corner or anything, so it needed silence. So I think she'd be a little dismayed at sort of the lack of silence in today's world, because your imagination wouldn't be working. I think she'd be a little dismayed at people's concentration levels not being perhaps as long as they were in the past. You know, all these great novels that she read, 19th century long novel, you know, she'd be probably quite dismayed that people don't have the patience for that anymore. But as I said before, she did embrace certain technology. So I was trying to think of certain things that I think she would have liked. I think she would have liked airplane travel, because it would get her from place to place very quickly. She crossed the Atlantic 60 times the old-fashioned way on a ship.
Wow.
So airplanes, I think she would have liked. And I kind of think she would have liked certain aspects of the research capability that we have now, internet capabilities and things like that, because she has a lot of the books in the library are research books, encyclopedias and dictionaries and multiple languages and things like that. So I think she might peek occasionally into Google, but yeah, I think some of the issues of modern life would appall her.
Yeah, agreed. Interesting you said that you think she would hate Instagram. I thought she might like it because of the visual aspect. Maybe it would be like it wouldn't be about her personal life, but her account would be about her, you know, her bookshelf, right? Or her interior decorating sort of designs and things.
Mm-hmm. But, like her travels, like that. Yeah, I agree. Mm-hmm. Like maybe her travel, because as you know, like that's one of the genres that she mastered, right? Travel writing. So I agree. I think she would not be putting portraits of herself on Instagram.
Yeah. Totally.
She wouldn't be like doing that.
She just might have, it might be all the dogs, you know, her dogs.
Yeah, right. Oh, this beautiful dog.
Dogstagram. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think that's I agree with that. I'm so glad that Anne mentioned the ghost stories. I'm teaching them next class. I have a class that I designed called Edith Wharton Inner Circle. And I just, that's a whole genre that is starting to become more familiar because there's a new edition now. It's like a facsimile of the book called Ghosts. It's just great because, first of all, more people that I teach tend to believe in ghosts than ever before. That's another conversation. But I love like her line, in response to the question, do you believe in ghosts? She said the celebrated reply is no, I don't believe in ghosts, but I'm afraid of them. And I think that's so good. Anyway, she mastered that genre. They're so good. They kind of chill you to the bone. And it's remarkable that she and what she achieved in that genre. There's a lot where that comes from.
Yeah, that's, I didn't know that about her writing. Another genre that I, yeah. But she just seems like a writer's writer. They kind of has figured out every genre and form.
I mean, even like her poetry now edited in a magnificent volume by Irene Goldman Price, who also edits the letters between Edith Wharton and Anna Bauman, her governess. Like they help represent and like Edith Wharton to us now. And the poetry, again, it was a well-kept secret, and it's getting its due now. It really is. It's a beautiful volume. If you haven't seen it, I highly recommend it. So
great.
I was only going to say about the ghost stories is that's one of the areas that makes her really approachable to modern audiences. I think everybody loves a good ghost story. Everybody loves to be scared. And at the Mount here, we've been running ghost stories for over 10 years. And they get people in here who've never heard of Edith Wharton, but you know, they want to come and get scared. And in the meantime, they learn a little bit about Wharton. So it's sort of an approachable, makes her more approachable.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Yeah. As we're kind of getting close to wrapping up, do either of you have any passages or quotes of any more? I'd love to hear more of Edith Wharton's words if you have any prepared. Maybe give her the last word on this.
I thought about that, and I have a couple. I'll just sort of say that for the House of Mirth, I mean this really like with my heart, like there's not a bad sentence in that book. and she really like masters the art of the English sentence, and she's very Oscar Wildean with her one-liners and her zingers. I could pull many from there. I'll not do that. I'll go right to The Age of Innocence, and this very frequently cited overview of this kind of coded world of old New York, very famous line describing the hieroglyphics, right? The direct quotation is from The Age of Innocence, and it's describing Newland Archer's world. So it goes as follows. In reality, they all lived in a kind of hieroglyphic world where the real thing was never said or done or even thought, but only represented by a set of arbitrary signs, as when Mrs. Welland, who knew exactly why Archer had pressed her to announce her daughter's engagement at the Beaufort Ball, and had indeed expected him to do no less, yet felt obliged to simulate reluctance and the air of having had her hand forced. So this idea, like the idea that like nobody's ever really saying what's going on, but it's all arbitrary signs, such as an arched eyebrow, a vague RSVP, and it's really like that to me crystallizes again the kind of world that she, Edith Wharton, helps us navigate. I keep referring to like corporate America or the world of academia. There's so much more where that comes from, but I'll just stop there.
Yeah, I love that. Great choice of quote. Like you said, this is very similar to our times now still. Yeah.
The Age of Innocence has so many of my favorite. The whole first page of The Age of Innocence is one of my favorite openings. It opens at an opera, and I love it. I love the opening of The Age of Innocence. But the quote that I thought of is, I think, one that Emily likes as well, because she quoted it as well, is much shorter. And it says, genius is a small use for a woman who does not know how to do her hair. that is from The Touchstone, which was a 1900 long story short, novella that she wrote. And it just, to me, it's like, it's funny. It's acidly funny. And that's so much of Wharton's writing that we like to emphasize to visitors. This is funny. They ask, why do you read it? It's funny.
Yes.
But it, you know, it pokes fun at cultural pretensions. It talks about sexual inequality, all in this very short little sentence. So that's always been one of my favorite quotes.
I love it too, and I'm so glad you read it, and when I share that with my students when I introduce you to Wharton, and they're kind of perplexed, and they're like, is she celebrating this? I'm like, of course not. I mean, she understood. I mean, and it happened to Edith Wharton herself for a good part of her life. You know, people are looking at her and saying she's not pretty enough. It happened after her decease, famously in the New Yorker in 2012. And I won't say more. You can just look it up. But she was, you know, like her appearance was referenced, and it wasn't really appropriate to be doing that to the first woman who won the Pulitzer Prize for fiction. It's not really appropriate to talk about her looks, and if she were a man, we wouldn't have done that. So yeah, she's she really is an awakener to many, many uncomfortable truths.
Yeah, well said. Was there anything else that we haven't covered that either of you wanted to talk about before we wrap it up?
I mean, I don't know. I think perhaps I might. Maybe I would add that decoration of houses is never kind of lost its cachet, and that like designers and architectural historians love that book. It's never gone out of print. And it's also, as Anne was saying, like, it's funny. Like, there are funny lines in there. And I think that really is like maybe a well-kept secret to people that don't know Edith Wharton, is that, and it makes sense that she would love the prose of Oscar Wilde and the plays of Oscar Wilde, because she, I think that they were kindred spirits. I think that they really had this kind of sort of gallows humor at times, and just such an acidic wit, really. And I wouldn't want to be on the receiving end, because there's some great insults in The House of Mirth directed at poor Gertie Farish. Like, it's astonishing. So, but we could go on, but I know we don't have time. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And remind our listeners again, Emily, that the Decoration of Houses is what you're working on now, a reprint of that. Yeah,
I am. Thank you. It's been a few years in the making, and I've got pulled away from it to work on the Blimsberg book. So I'm working on I'm editing and introducing and annotating a volume. And Anne knows that, like, this beautiful book, The Decoration of Houses, which Edith Wharton co-wrote with the Boston architect Ogden Codman Jr. He's also an interior designer as well as an architect. There are so many references that just go unglossed. There are French expressions. There's one Greek expression, and they're never footnoted. So what I would like to add to the conversation is 30 pages of footnotes. and an introduction from an Edith Wharton scholar. So that's my hope, and it's under contract now. So
great.
That's a cool. Thank you.
Yeah, I look forward to reading it.
So, and piggybacking off of that as well, is that Edith Wharton built this house about 5 years. 4 years actually after she wrote The Decoration of Houses. And so we sometimes call it an autobiographical house, because a lot of the ideas that she wrote about in The Decoration of Houses are reflected in this house. Sometimes she didn't follow her own advice, and that's kind of funny as well, but still you get a sense sort of her personality from the house itself. So, you know, we don't have the furniture, as we say often, but we do have the house, the bones of the house, which reflects a lot of the principles in The Decoration of Houses.
That's interesting. And for our listeners, can tell us a little more about the Mount, where you're at, and how they can go visit.
So the Mount is in Lenox, Massachusetts, which is in the western part of Massachusetts. It was built as a summer house, so it is not open all year round. We open in May, and we run from May usually until the end of October. And our website is edithwharton.org, and that has a lot of the information about it. We our mission, so to speak, is to celebrate the humanitarian, literary, and artistic legacy of Edith Wharton, but we also strive to be a cultural center for the local community. And there's 49 and a half acres of beautiful grounds that people can walk on for free. You don't have to pay admissions if you actually get into the house for a house tour. So we have guided tours, self-guiding tours. We have an audio tour that we translated into Spanish last year as well. So trying to reach a lot of people who might not normally come here, again, with the ghost as well. We run programs during the summer. We're right now getting ready for next season. So we're booking, we have a lecture series that is approaching its 30th anniversary this year.
Wow.
30 years, and it is authors of it's changed over the years, but a lot of biography, a lot of history, a lot of women of note, and very popular, sells out every year. So and we always have a Wharton reading program where we read her short story, That on the Terrace. The Terrace is sort of the pièce de résistance of the house that looks out over the gardens. And you can just picture Edith sitting there with her tea and her dogs. And it's a great place to sit and listen to some of her work. So that's just some of the things. And actually next month, March already, we host a writers in residence program of sort of emerging and upcoming writers, and they come for a week each and work. They can't live here because that's against all kinds of regulations, but they work in the rooms, work in Edith Wharton's bedroom, which is of course where she wrote. And so we've been running that for quite a few years too as well, and that's pretty magical for the writers who come here.
That sounds great. Yeah. Next time I visit home in New Hampshire, I'll try to swing down.
Yeah, anybody in the vicinity, please do come visit. You can walk the grounds for free, as I said, any time of year. And the house itself opens in the middle of May.
That's great. Yeah. Well, Anne and Emily, thank you very much for joining me today. I know I had a blast talking with you, and looking forward to reading more Edith Wharton, to be honest. And yeah, can't wait to hear about your future projects and read them as well. So. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much. It's so great to be with both of you.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Nation of Writers podcast, part of the American Writers Museum podcast network. If you'd like to learn more about American writers and their impact on our history, our culture, and our daily lives, find us online or come see us in person. The American Writers Museum is open Thursdays through Mondays from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., closed on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. Once again, thank you for listening, and to all you writers out there, thank you for writing.